Welcome to the Wellness Within podcast. We are a nonprofit wellness center for patients, survivors, caregivers, and families affected by the trauma of cancer. We provide a wide range of services that enhance an individual's ability to experience quality of life. And we believe that everyone should have access to our programs and conversations, which are offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied the support they need. If you find inspiration in what we share, we invite you to consider supporting Wellness Within through a donation. Your generosity enables us to continue offering these valuable resources to our community. To make a donation and contribute to the well-being of those facing cancer, please visit our website at wellnesswithin.org or click the link in the episode description. Your support makes a difference, so thank you for being a vital part of our mission. Together, we empower whole person well-being, bridging gaps, and reconnecting to what is most meaningful. Welcome to Wellness Within. Join us for relaxing meditations and enlivening conversations about topics that support wellness in the presence of cancer. We would like to thank Umpqua Bank, UC Davis Health, and Kaiser Permanente, who in part sponsor this podcast. To access our class schedule, to make a donation, or to sign up for our newsletter, please visit wellnesswithin.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Within podcast series. I am Patty Brown, founder of Wellness Within, and I am here today with Dr. Samantha Siegel, and I am over the moon excited. I think I met you just not even a year ago. I'm like one of those, what do they call them, fans for a rock star. You know, I read everything that she posts, and I am so blown away by her as a human, her passion, and everything that she's cooking up to want to do with her life. So with no further ado, let me introduce you and tell you a little bit more about Dr. Samantha Siegel. She's an internist in Kaiser Permanente. She has survived relapse refractory Hodgkin's lymphoma, including auto bone marrow transplant in June 2022. This has made her passionate about cancer survivorship, integrative medicine, and personal narrative impacting the illness experience. She hopes to pioneer a longitudinal cancer survivorship care model beginning at diagnosis, I hope you're all hearing this, that can be replicated in other healthcare systems. She's focused on elevating cancer survivorship to its own multidisciplinary board certification status. That's pretty big. I don't know if you all realize that, but that's big. And Dr. Siegel lives in Davis, California with her husband, three kids, an energetic dog. They enjoy outdoor activities and plant-based living. Did I leave anything out?
Oh, man. You know, that sounds like a lot. To me, this morning, with the kind of morning that I'm having with my brain, I'm having one of those bad chemo brain days. So even just taking that in my own bio, wow, that's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's big stuff.
Well, you've got big dreams that you're chasing after, and that is a lot. And a lot of people don't have that kind of level of ambition, especially in the healthcare system.
Yeah, and it's having that ambition and yet operating in a body and a mind that has been through everything that I've been through, which means that some days what this looks like is that I'm having trouble getting my words out. I want to cry out of frustration because I have all these things that I want to do and my body's not cooperating. You know, I'm stiff, things hurt. And yet I do. I have these big dreams and I have this fire beneath me that gets me out of bed every day to just want to make this experience a little bit better for people.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you being your candor about sharing with our listeners and about how you woke up today and what you've been dealing with, because I think it makes it very real. And sometimes people put doctors in boxes and not humans. And with, you know, two cancer diagnoses and still practicing medicine, this is not trivial.
Yeah.
And you make it real. And I think that's one of the things that I have so much respect for you for, is you make it real. You're honest about what you're dealing with, you know, both with your passion and what you're dealing with. I want to say something a little bit. One of the things that Dr. Sam and I have in common is we both are a lover of Viktor Frankl's work. Mm-hmm. And if those of you who don't know, if those of us who are looking, I just looked at, my copy. It's 40 years old, my copy. It's all yellow pages. I love it. I love Viktor Frankl and man's search for meaning. And
woman's search for meaning.
I know. I was thinking people that too. Search when I said that. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, but you know, that was.
Yeah,
When did he?
It's okay.
We'll give him a little pass on that one. But anyway, so this premise is regarding the significance of creating meaning in your life. So one of the things that you connect to is the significance of creating meaning in your life after cancer. And can you expand on that, exactly what that means for you?
Yeah, absolutely. For better or for worse, I've just had a very eclectic life with a lot of different experiences. I have not come from this, what I viewed as a very traditional doctor path, where I had this very, you know, together family and a lot of doctors. And it was just sort of the expectation that I would become this and do this thing. Like, I had some times growing up, you know, I lost my father tragically in a car accident when I was a baby. And then my mom kind of remarried to my dad now, who raised me, but there was a lot of trauma in our house. And my brother, you know, grew up with some mental health issues, some substance use issues. He's doing well now. You know, I went to a state school, and it wasn't a given that I would go into medicine. And I felt that all along the way. I felt like from an early age, I sort of felt like I could have become anything. Like, I could have wound up on the street, or I could have become a doctor. Like, I felt that connection with everyone and everything from my youth. And so making sense of that was always sort of hard. And I felt that I was lucky to be born into a family that had resources, to have married, you know, my husband and connect with his family that does have a lot of doctors, and they have resources. So I had a lot of luck and some really amazing mentorship and guidance along the way. And it was kind of a bumpy path. Like, it was not always a given that I would sort of wind up here. So I kind of developed this relationship with becoming a doctor, where I put this on a pedestal, and it became like medicine would be an armor that would protect me from all the things that I saw in my life around me. I saw my brother making some really difficult choices, and it landed him over a number of years, like, you know, he almost died, and, you know, trouble with the law, things like that. I saw friends from college that I knew in my earlier years kind of wind up with some difficult life choices. And so I suddenly, it wasn't just an ambition academically. It was like, well, if I just become a doctor, then I will have arrived and I'll be okay. And so I sort of I created it like this armor. And so then I think that resulted in this sort of like separation of selves, where I had like the together doctor me self. And then I had like the other me with all these sort of real life experiences, and it wasn't really fully integrated. And I was on the struggle bus for a long time, just sort of making sense with all of that. And then I met my husband, and he had a lot of serious health issues from the time that we met. And so all those circumstances of things that I went through growing up, and then getting through his various health trials and tribulations, which included testicular cancer and a liver transplant, like really serious things. Oh. This was all before I got cancer. And all those things made me feel broken. Like, I felt defective and kind of broken in that part of my life. Like, and that I had to keep it compartmentalized. Like, once I donned that white coat and that cloak, that armor, that would be a person who sort of knew the answers and kind of had it all together. And then in my other life, I felt out of control. I felt like I have no control over was constantly white knuckle gripping internally in my life, afraid of losing him because he is just my best friend and an amazing person. So I felt this like divide internally. And then my cancer just completely cracked me wide open. And it was the thing that sort of released me from that pattern. Like my cancer was initially a grenade to my life. It was like, okay, I needed this. Like, come on, you know, after everything we've been through, now I'm going to get cancer. I mean, it was like horribly right. shocking in the beginning.
Yeah.
And yet, especially in the first 6 months, I just sort of treated it like, okay, this is just yet another obstacle. And I didn't really change anything about my life. I just sort of took the chemo and tried to get through it like it was another speed bump. And I didn't really look at it like, is this trying to show me something?
Mm-hmm. Then, not terribly uncommon, I would think, with some people.
Yeah. And I really just want to like say that it's okay if you don't have this relationship with your cancer. This is my experience. And so I know that everybody has their own thing. And for some people, it is kind of a speed bump. I mean, my husband was not, he views his cancer as like a side note compared to some of the other things that he went through with his health. So, and that's interesting because for me, it was like, you know, it's completely transformed in me.
Yeah,
but yeah, once the relapse came about a month after I was in remission, it just, I started thinking, well, oh, maybe this is trying to show me something. Maybe I need to completely unzip myself. Maybe I need to like undo everything I think I am, put all of that down. And then especially during my bone marrow transplant, I almost died. I really felt that I was in that liminal space between life and death for a few days. And I said, I might not make it. I might never get back to medicine. And if I'm lucky enough to live through this experience, like, will I be okay just being me? Not externally producing, like being a doctor and doing all this amazing stuff. Like if all that I am is just me and I'm just, you know, I'm a mom and a wife, and I'm just existing in the world and trying to be kind when I go to the gas station and say hello to somebody and pay my bill at the grocery store and, you know, at the checkout. And that's all that my life is that enough? Am I okay? You know? And yeah. I started really letting go of that. And when I really put it down and started looking at my life that way, that's when things started to heal. And then as I was healing and starting to think about maybe a path back to medicine or a path forward in medicine. I don't, sometimes the word back is very triggering for me.
Right.
But I just realized, you know, maybe everything in my life led up to this. And I am perfectly and uniquely suited to do this, to talk about surviving, to talk about survivorship and thriving. And how do you hold like such painful things that have happened in your life and the honesty, the brutal honesty of that, and feel like maybe all of these things happened to me at this time in my life and in my medical career so that I could be a person to show others the way forward. That, yeah, you can have all these really serious and hard things happen that are not fun. And you can still be happy and you can find moments of joy and then sometimes intense grief, like all within the same 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I just, and then I was, you know, thought a lot about Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and just the circumstances that he lived through. Mm-hmm. And I started realizing, well, maybe there's something in there for me. And I've always been kind of, I would call it like a transformation junkie or a mindset junkie. You know, there's this podcast, the Rich Roll podcast, and it's kind of evolved over the years, but in the earlier times, he really has a lot of everyday people who kind of overcome various things. You know, people who were really struggling with heavy substance use disorder and then became like ultra marathoners and, you know, a lot of, and so the podcast is not just where they are now. It's the how. How did they do that? How did they crawl out of that hole?
Right, right.
And so, yeah.
Is that one of, I was just looking down at my notes that I had written, and one of my favorite quotes, many of Viktor Frankl's, is to live is to suffer, to survive is to find meaning in the suffering, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Is, okay, what does this all mean for me, for me personally, not for, I mean, your path is your path. And if everybody else is to find their own, but to be able to pump the brakes and to say, what does this all mean for me? And almost as you had said something to me when we talked a month or so ago about somebody said something to you about what makes your soul sing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was such a beautiful phrase. And so I'm going to ask you, mm-hmm. when everything that you said and where you land today, because it will change. But right now, what are you aware of that makes your soul sing? Mm-hmm. I know, big question.
It is a big question. You know, it's funny. Sometimes it's really small things. It's like,
yes.
Sometimes it could even be a brief exchange with somebody that I am walking by. I was in a parking lot the other day or I was walking out of a store. I can't remember exactly, but some guy almost bumped into me and I was kind of not paying great attention. And he was kind of not paying great attention. And he looked at me and he apologized. He's like, I'm sorry. And I was like, no, it's all right, man. I need to look up too. You know, I said something like that. And like our eyes connected. And our soul, I felt his soul or something.
Yeah.
I just felt like our energies connect.
Yeah.
And he was just like, oh man, it was so nice. And he was like, oh, I almost bumped into you. And we had this brief exchange, total stranger. And then we both were like, oh, sorry, you know, and we smiled, but we were both really genuine in our exchange with one another. And something about that interaction, I was like giddy. Going to my car. Like, I love being alive. Dang it, I love being alive. I don't know what it was about that guy.
genuine connection. Seeing another person, looking mm-hmm. into their eyes.
Yes.
And that kind of connection. I mean, that at least I have come to know you to this juncture is it. And I say this to everyone. When I met Dr. Sam, she was fiercely looking into my eyes, like, finding like, no, look at me when you're talking, because I'll go up and I'll find my thoughts and gather them and come back and look at a person. And she never lost that connection of trying to track. You were tracking where I was going. Like, I'm here. I am listening to you. I am paying attention. I see you. And that fits when I think about it, what you just said is that enlivening experience to connect ever so briefly with another person. You know, or the small joys. I think we kind of make that mistake, don't you think? It's like we think it has to be this big grandiose thing that makes our soul sing. And it's like, in reality, it's the breeze against your face when you go outside or mm-hmm. seeing birds, you know, joyfully flying together in a group or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it has to be this big grandiose thing. At least that's where I've landed finally in my life. It's like, oh, it's mm-hmm. the small joys. Just, you know, we gather them along the way.
Yeah.
You go, and you take that breath and you hold that.
Absolutely. What you're just saying, particularly about the sun shining through the trees. Bring me back to that if I forget. But I've also been doing ecstatic dance recently. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's this kind of beautiful gathering of people dancing to mostly mm-hmm. instrumental music, but kind of this idea of music as medicine. And everybody who goes is really going with the intention of just trying to dance it out, whether that's dancing out your grief, dancing out your joy, trying to heal something. And that happens like where I live in Davis, we have it once per month and it's always incredible. I could go in and whatever kind of mood, whatever happened at my house that morning, you know, everybody's bickering and, you know, the house is a mess and just leave feeling completely elevated, like on a different plane of, and it's because of this, the music and the movement of energy through myself.
Yeah.
But then also connecting with other people while they're trying to raise their energy. And there's something about that that's very healing and joyful. Like just somebody's really having a moment where they're smiling and they're feeling it and you're around them and then you're feeling it too. And it really does something. I started going to ecstatic dance because I noticed that when I was dancing in my kitchen, that my legs hurt less. I have pretty bad peripheral neuropathy from my chemotherapy and gosh, my legs would ache. And then I noticed when I was listening to music and like dancing with my daughter and my kids in the kitchen, I started going, oh, wait a minute, my legs don't hurt. What's up with that? You know, just the happy chemicals of dancing and the music and feeling good. Exactly. So then I started thinking like, oh, maybe I need to incorporate this and purposefully do this in my life. So dancing makes my soul sing, connecting with people, and then also helping somebody else find their why. You know, it's not my why. And I think that that's a big part of what I want to see in cancer care and survivorship is just allowing people the opportunity to ask the question, like, do I have any underlying beliefs about what cancer is doing in my life? Like, what does it mean to me? What can I do with this?
Yeah.
And for some people, that's going to be nothing. You know, they won't look at it that way. And that's okay. It doesn't have to be this big, expansive, transformative thing for everybody. But I think a lot of people, when you start asking them, like, what's going on in their life around the time when they were diagnosed, many people will tell you, like, you know, toxic job, hard marriage, all kinds of things. And there's something about addressing those things that might be protective. And so I just want to allow people to begin to understand that there may be people who say, oh, is there anything more that I can do? I hear people asking their oncologists a lot. I ask my oncologist that a lot, but they can't tell you, like, oh, you know, that broken relationship that you have with this family member, like, maybe work on that. That might heal something in you. You know, they don't know that. Right. And so that's kind of for us to think about and look into.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's stay in that theme of energy, because that's an interesting one. I'm trying to remember, you shared with me that you learned how precious your energy is and the importance of knowing what to put forth regarding your energy. Mm-hmm. So can you expand on that a little bit? It's like, how do you recognize that? Because when you're in a profession where you're helping people, sometimes you give too much, or you're feeling you're holding other people's energy. So that's talk about a dance, right? You know, it's a mm-hmm. very interesting dance that we do with energy. But I think if my memory serves me, when we had the conversation a while back and you talked about how the significance of really, really watching your tank and really reserving the fuel, your own energy, and how mm-hmm. much, how you do that balance. How do you do that? Do you have a way of knowing, or how do you put checks and balances in place for yourself?
You know, it's kind of a muscle that you have to practice using. I'm still not great at it, but I'm getting better. I can tell when I overshoot it. Like this week, I think that's why I woke up with just gnarly chemo brain today, because I overshot this week in terms of my energetic obligations, and then just the imbalance of giving out more than I'm replenishing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, that looks like, professionally, I think maybe that has been an interesting dance for me, because coming back from my cancer, I sort of realized that I don't have endless amounts of energy. I mean, I think when I do these various projects or recording, like, I sound like super energetic, and I have moments of that, but it's fits and spurts. It's not like I am up here all the time. There's time, like last night, I mean, I hit the couch at 8 and I was like, I'm done. Yeah. You know? So knowing that my energy is not endless, what do I want to spend it on? And for me, that became like, you know, my life is precious. I almost lost my life. I don't feel that tomorrow is guaranteed to me. I really hope I'm here for a really long time, but tomorrow is not guaranteed. Yeah. And so knowing that I don't have all the time in the world, I don't have endless amounts of energy, what is important enough for me to be diverting my energy away from my children, away from my husband, away from myself, you know, and just replenishing, like, what is important enough for me to be doing that? And for me, the answer is cancer survivorship, helping people find their way, having these conversations, doing that medicine, teaching the medicine of survivorship to other providers in the medical community. That is my thing. For somebody else, it might be like, gosh, you know, I haven't picked up a paintbrush in years, and I used to paint all the time. And now I need to make time for that, because I don't have endless energy. you know? And going back to my professional thing, that was also carving out this position. I'm going to be transitioning into a new role in the next couple of months, going from sort of primary care doctor to something called an onco-PCP, which is a primary care provider specifically for somebody going through the cancer experience. And that could be at a number of different touch points in time, like the very beginning, just come from the ER, have had a difficult scan, you're going to need follow-up. You know, they send you out of the ER, like follow up with your PCP. Well, I'm going to be that PCP. Wow. And then sort of shepherding people through the experience and then the afterwards. And I realized, and how I got to that, it wasn't like, oh, here, we have this position for you. Like, this position mm-hmm. does not exist. I'm going to be the inaugural person in my healthcare organization, sort of doing this role and hoping to sort of build this model and to spread it. But that came out of a realization where I don't have endless energy. And so taking care of people experiencing cancer can't mm-hmm. be a side hustle passion project. I don't have that energy. There's 24 hours in a day. I need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Yeah. I only feel like I can work this many hours because I need time for self-care and this and that. So within those hours, like, this has got to be what I do. And it's valuable enough. It's a service that people need. I need it. You know, it's a service that people need. So then starting to have those conversations with my work and to show them like, hey, this is a thing that's really mm-hmm. valuable, that's needed, and I'm perfectly suited to do it, and that back and forth. So that was a conversation, and it took a long time to sort of achieve that, but it's really exciting. And I hope that other people can find that. And especially, I think work in cancer is a really, when you talk about energy and people, you know, sort of returning to work or maintaining some type of work. Right now, it's like this very binary decision, like work or don't work, you know, put you on full disability or not. But I think there's a lot of flavors that are like in between, some sort you know, reduced, modified level of engagement. Like, maybe we still have things to contribute that are really meaningful and valuable, even though we can't maintain the exact productivity as we could exactly before we were diagnosed, but that doesn't mean that we're any less valuable. So we just have to change and like shift. What is it that we do have to offer that's really meaningful and valuable
do you, I mean, as I'm listening to you, I'm getting flooded with memories of many conversations I've had over the years with folks dealing with a cancer diagnosis and going back to work, having to go back to work, not necessarily because it's passionate work, but having to mm-hmm. go back to work. And people looking at you and saying, you look great, and expecting the same prior to when you had your cancer diagnosis. And the struggle of, I have to maintain that somehow. I have to give it all. And to not have the, give yourself that, I don't even know what it's called, to be honest with you, but maybe you can help me with this, Sam. It's like, if I don't, I could lose my job. If I don't, you know, keep up to that level, even though I can't anymore the same way, nor do I even really want to, but I have to. And you feel that pressure. And to me, it just feels like, I don't know. I mean, my first thing is educate employers, you know, I help people understand that, kind of like what you and I talked about before we started recording, is you go through treatments. That's one thing. And everybody goes, okay, you're better now. You finished your chemo, your radiation, whatever else, you're good, right? And you're back to work. Like it never happened. Like, you're all good. We can just wipe mm-hmm. our hands and moving on. And it's like,
all better now?
That doesn't happen easily. I mean, some people get lucky and it does. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that everybody does, but a lot of people don't feel the same physically, mentally, you know, emotionally when you go back to work. And people have this vision of a person, especially, you know, like in your case, you were transformed by your experience, even leading up to it. And then the crescendo of your, you know, cancer experience is, and you come across, you know, energetically, like you said earlier, you know, it's like, people don't know what to do with that. They don't understand. And so how do you, and I'm not thinking that you have the answer necessarily, but is to affirm to other people dealing with this situation, is like, how do you take care of yourself when you recognize that? I mean, Can you have that conversation with an employer? Can you have that conversation with yourself and say, it doesn't mean I'm not as smart. It doesn't mean I'm not this or that or whatever. It means I had cancer and it was hard and it robbed some things of me. And there is a residual after treatments, you know, get the treatment, get the diagnosis, and then all the other stuff that happens, you know, it's like, this is not, like you said about, you know, how do people crawl out of that hole and like, okay, I'm back. You know, this Pollyanna approach is like, it's not always that easy.
Yeah.
Well, any words of wisdom based off of your own personal experience on that?
I kept having this memory, this visual of, I called it Invasion of the Body Snatchers. When I would go to the grocery store in town and I'd run into people, especially as my hair started growing back and started getting, you know, better color and a little more pep in my step. And I'd run into people at the grocery store and they would talk to me as if I was the me before this happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I sort of looked okay. And they'd be like, hey, how are you, Sam? You look great. How are things going? And I'm just like, oh my God, you know, on the inside, right? Like it's, they have no idea. And part of me wants to just like bust out and be like, oh my God, I almost died. And I saw what happens when we almost cross over and the interconnectedness of thing and the everythingness and the nothingness. And oh my God, it's so much and I'll never be the same. And I'm trying to find my way in life. But usually I don't say any of that. I just smile and say, yeah, I'm good.
Oh yeah, right. Well,
you know, it's like, and it's sort of because it's too much. There's the enormity of this experience is not for everybody. I learned how to sort of strategically disclose the level of information, and what I mean by that is that in the beginning, I acted like a cancer beauty pageant queen. Like, hey, I'm Sam, I have cancer. Like, let me tell you everything about my cancer and you know what it's like. And sort of, I felt like everybody deserved a front row seat or an explanation to my suffering.
Yeah.
And I invited them to that. And then it was actually my children who helped me see how like traumatic that was, because I saw that it was repetitively traumatic for them. And then I realized, oh, maybe it's actually repetitively traumatic for me to be saying that over and over again to the people who are not arriving with the intention of like, really, it's more out of like a curiosity kind of thing than the fact that they're intimately involved in my life. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of learned, you know, there's some people that I'll say like, yeah, I'm okay. And, you know, it's been a lot, but I'm doing okay. And then there's other people who I'll give the more involved answer to like what that looks like.
You cherry pick. You should.
And at work too. At work too. I mean, there's people who you sort of have to have these ongoing discussions of like what your needs are, how you might be accommodated. And that's when it is really important to work with your, you know, provider. I have this ongoing give and take with my doctor in terms of my modified work notes, where I have to explain to her like the issues that I'm having and why I'm not quite back to 100% of working capacity, you know, 7 months out from the end of my treatment, meaning like my brain is slower. Sometimes I need breaks. Mm-hmm. You know, after about this many hours, my ability to do things is just sort of not the same as it was before. And I'm still healing. And I think that it's one conversation, you know, depending on how heavy the treatment was and how far out you are from the end of it versus like after you've gone beyond a certain amount of time and maybe you sort of stalled out in terms of your progress or you know, you're not progressing anymore as you thought you would, then that's a different conversation of like, well, does this need to be a permanent kind of disability type of thing or modify? Mm-hmm. Is there an ability to work with my employer to have like modified accommodations? And those conversations are really hard and we're not good at them in medicine. We're not. Mm-hmm. So
right.
I just want to like make that fully transparent that you've got to be a fierce self-advocate.
Fierce self-advocate. I love that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And be okay. It doesn't mean you're weak. If anything, it's tapping into that pool of strength that got you through to this point to be able to. I mean, because people just don't know. They're just uneducated. They just don't know.
And I also started to see, like, I still feel shame about saying that I need a different schedule than everybody else. Like, no, I don't think I'm special or that I need to have a more chill schedule than everybody else, but I feel as if my life depends on it. Like, if I don't make this time to rest and take care of my body post-treatment after everything that's happened to this body, if I don't make time for that, there could be drastic health consequences for me in terms of like chronic stress and relapse, risk. And things like that. Cause they don't really know, but you know, my type of lymphoma, it's immune system cancer. And so the stress and rest connection and overall health and well-being, there is something to that. We just don't fully understand how it works yet. So I feel that for me, maintaining my sleep, maintaining my stress, and that's part of the work discussion. And that's hard because it doesn't feel good. Just because I've learned how to do it and I've learned how to like hold the line of what I need doesn't mean that it's comfortable. I still feel very uncomfortable and a little bit ashamed that I need these sort of special things in order to get. But I also feel that's balanced out by like when I interact with a patient and I am my full me and I can tell that I've made them feel really good. And that feels so great. And if I was totally depleted and sucked dry and not protecting myself in the same way, then I wouldn't have been able to give to that person that way.
Right. So it's also, it sounds like it is choosing where you're going to put that forth, that energy, and where you're deciding to pull back from. Mm-hmm. And for you, like, patients will get good care.
Yes.
Because I'm, you know, throttling back over here. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, pulling back here because something has to give. Mm-hmm. Think that's wise to
do. Yeah. I mean, I've even started talking to my organization about, well, hey, I've never been the doctor who could bang out like 10, 20 minute visits super efficiently. I'm just not, you know.
Yeah. What a surprise. Chatty Cathy.
And now that issue might even be worse in terms of my how fast I am, but I've always been super thorough and I feel still very strong in that regard. So I've even said to them, hey, what if we create like small group visits where I could have 5 or 6 people who want to be in a small group and we have an hour together? Like, what about that? You know, because I could convey all these important things and we could have question answer,
learn from each other,
like exploring different models. Like, I could still be of use and do great things in this organization that helps us and helps patients have great outcomes, even though I might not be able to sort of efficiently bang through like a 10-minute visit, you know? So, and I think that healthcare is starting to transform enough where patients are sort of demanding and expecting different things.
Right.
Whereas organizationally, we're going, maybe we do need to start shifting the way that we do things and offering patients kind of what they want and what is more applicable in their lives, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Let's shift not the topic as much as the word energy. Mm-hmm. So when you think about energy, it feels like it has a lot of different meanings and components to it. So I'm curious if when you had your near-death experience, I know how it definitely has shaped you today, but how has that affected you and how you perceive energy now or energy vampires and, you know, the whole notion of your experience of understanding energy differently? Can you expand on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll try to sort of explain, put words to my experience as best I can.
Okay.
It's a little bit tough because it was a very non-verbal experiential type of sensation in that space. But I think that's one of the things I've been kind of dealing with ever since then, is just trying to put words to it. So I say that since my transplant, I'm like a radio that got more stations. I'm just sort of in tune with a lot more frequencies than before. I think maybe some of this was always here. It just society and kind of my tunnel vision in life maybe put blinders on to a lot of it. Like, maybe all of this was always here, but something about my energy, and for some people that might be spirit. I mean, I don't want to make this like a religious or spiritual thing, but for me, I felt when I almost died in the hospital, what that was like was that I had this feeling that when we're alive, we have this energy, electrical current, spirit, whatever, that's concentrated around our physical body, like our vehicle. And then for me, when I felt really close to the end of my life, it didn't feel like all of a sudden it was a nothingness. And then like the lights are turned off and it's void and black and forever and there's nothingness. It felt like an everythingness, like that I was separating from this physical body, but that I was becoming part of everything, like an energetic dispersion, like confetti exploding, like fireworks. Yeah. I felt that I would be everything and everywhere at the same time. Like that's what my experience was. And so much so that I sort of became obsessed with this visual of when you're sort of in canopy of trees and you have beams of sunlight peeking through the trees and you can sort of see the beams, you know, going down to the ground. And sometimes you could see like the particles in the air, like going in and out of the beam of light.
Yes.
I sort of became really fixated with that visual, and not just because that's what I saw when I was in the liminal space between this life and whatever happens afterwards, but it's not just that I saw that. I felt I was becoming that. Like I was becoming the beam of light. I was becoming the trees and the sky and everything.
Wow.
And then I didn't fully become that and cross over to whatever that is. I went zoop, and I got sucked back down or gravitationally pulled back or whatever keeps us here in this life. Like I came back, and especially as I sort of, as my stem cells engrafted is what we call it. When like the seeds take hold of the stem cells and they grow new bloodlines, and I was getting a little more substance every day, farther and farther out, I felt more substantial and grounded again in this physical body. And yet ever since then, I have retained some of that everythingness in my like experience now in this body. And what that means is that I'm just very in touch with when things feel good. I'm also in touch with when something feels bad. And that could be like an energy vampire, and an energy vampire can be a person, place, or thing. It could be sort of an experience where I'm just sort of like, oh my God, I feel totally drained after doing that thing, you know, disproportionately so for the level of like physical exertion that I might have done. Or it could be, you know, it could be a person that's like, oh, we are not, this doesn't feel right. You know, this relationship doesn't feel right. It could be a path in my life. Like, you know, I was previously on that path and now I feel like I'm supposed to be going to this other path, and I can feel like a tension inside that I'm not on the right path. And that, I think that attention to that feeling internally, that friction, that tension is something that I'm just much more in tune with after my near-death experience.
I want to make sure people, when they're listening to this, it's not that you can't have that. You have to have a near death experience to have that. But that, what that did coming back is that, like you said, is like you didn't realize you had it before. It just became more obvious to you because of that experience. We all have the ability, if we allow for ourselves, to tune into and listen to ourselves. Listen to why am I drained? Listening to how do I feel after that exchange? Or how does that person make me feel when I'm around them? Or what about this job? Or what, you know, it's like to listen.
Yeah. And one thing I've learned is that, you know, some of the best teachers we can look to are children. Yeah. Like my kids have been my little spirit guides throughout this, you know, because I think we've all had that experience where you look at a baby and they just, especially a newborn, they seem to know everything. They have this expression on them, on their faces, this countenance, like where they know the secrets of the universe, and they don't know how to talk yet. So they can't really convey it, but you can feel it when you're sort of around a newborn or even just like a young, playful child. And I think one of the things we all love about children, why they're so refreshing, is that they will just tell you, I don't like that.
Right, right.
That doesn't feel good. You know, like they know. Right. They know. And then, you know, we train that out of ourselves. And like, so
we're not allowed to have those feelings.
Yeah, we're not allowed to have those feelings. Like, yeah, you know,
we have to deal with that. That's life. Like, no, actually, no.
Yeah. Yes, and I think life. Some of that is starting to change. Yeah. I think some of it's starting to change. Like, you know, when I was growing up, I was like, no, you give Uncle Bobby a kiss. If he wants to kiss you, you kiss him, you know? And when I was a kid, I was like, no, I don't want to kiss Uncle Bobby, you know? And now societally, it's becoming a little more like, okay, sensitive you're to in that, charge yeah. of your body. And like you, what you are, you can say if you don't want to do that, you know, like right, that's okay. Right. And I think we're sort of starting to catch up to bodily autonomy and all those kind of things.
Right.
But,
right.
but yeah, I think children, so I think my near-death experience like reconnected me with sort of my childlike intuition about,
oh, I love that.
You know, what's right for me before like I realized what society's expectations were for me. Because one of the things, especially about my near-death experience and my transplant is, and my cancer, what this all showed me and what I hope can be available to people without having to have a near-death experience
yeah.
is that just releasing from fear and releasing from expectations. Because before this happened, I felt like I was kind of living in a prison of my own expectations and that I was living somebody else's script for my life. I had that feeling. I didn't have the words for it back then,
right.
but I sort of right. had this internal feeling of like, occasionally it was almost like a like an exhaustion or a drudgery. Like I'm yeah. just going through the motions. I'm doing this because I'm supposed to be doing it. I just wasn't fully awake. And this kind of shook me awake. Yeah. And maybe that could be available. Maybe somebody just listening to this who isn't anywhere near close to that can sort of, maybe that can shake them awake.
Right.
You know, and they don't have to go to the in-between and almost dying and all that. That'd be great.
Right, right. Well, I think what you're saying is so true overall. It's like, it doesn't even have to be, there are many things in life that can shake you awake, that can bring you to your knees,
mm-hmm.
you know, and those are sort of the moments, right? That's yeah. what the whole thing about suffering is like, okay. It's not that you're ever going to figure out the why did I suffer, but is what did I learn and what do I want to bring forward and what do I need? For me, I look at it like doing an inventory, you know, it's like going in that junk drawer. You know, why am I saving this? You know, what am I holding on to this for? You know, is clearing out and really having an opportunity. At least maybe it's just been all the years of my experience in working with folks dealing with cancer and their caregivers, care partners actually, is to be able to say, what is getting in the way of you being able to care for yourself and to listen to you, to mm-hmm. your inner voice,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to explore that and that's what you said about the fear. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, why is that so scary?
Mm-hmm.
To give yourself permission. If you got another shot here, how do you want this to feel? How do you want to feel, you know, in this life? Not just what do you want to do? The goal thing is how do you want to feel? How do you want to move about in the world? What do you want? What do you notice now? What's important mm-hmm. to you? What's really important to you?
Yep. And I think one of the things that you and I have talked about is this concept of the Japanese have such great words for yes. certain concepts, like the beams of light. There's a word for that. It's called komorebi. Another great word, Japanese concept is arugamama. And that means like, I think it literally translates to as it is. And it's mm-hmm. sort of this concept. It's not like a passive acceptance of like, oh, I'm just so accepting. I'm going to be Zen with like whatever's thrown my way. It's more of like an active engagement with it. Like, what choices do I have? Like with, and this goes back to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Like, with things exactly as they are now, what choices do I have? What can I do? Not like focused on what's being taken from me. And because there's a lot of that, but it's like with things exactly as they are now, what choices do I have? Can I stop and take 3 deep breaths? Can I stretch? If I'm feeling really sad and blue, am I going to drink a half bottle of tequila or am I going to like pick up a phone and call a friend and say like, I am really down in the dumps. Can you right. take a walk with me? You know, and we have a lot of these choices. And so getting more in touch with the arugamama, with things exactly as they are now, like what can we do with this when it yeah. feels like we're in a corner? and cancer made me feel that way. It was like, it felt like life and death. Like it was black or white. It's over or it's not. And I'm like, and then I realized all the choices in between, you know, with this diagnosis, with this new reality that I'm living, what can I do? What can I offer? Do I have something that's meaningful to contribute? How can I stay connected with people and as functional as possible in my new way with my new abilities? Some of them, I am definitely differently abled than before. I'll put it that way. Like I have different abilities. Some are more advanced and compared to my life as it was before, I can't do things. So I choose to focus on what I can do that helps me to feel better. It's not like I've got it all figured out now and I'm all good. And like, you know, I'm totally cancer woke, but I still experience great grief sometimes. I still experience loss, sadness, fear. Fear is a big one. I just have a better toolkit now for how do I help myself feel better? What choices do I have in this moment when I get that horrible pang of fear? What can I do right now in the first 30 seconds to make myself feel better? Mm-hmm. What can I do within the hour? And sometimes I have to break it down. You were asking me earlier, like, do I have a way to get through the difficult times? And am I always like feeling great? And the answer is no, I'm not always feeling great. And sometimes I have to go from like this huge planner that I have that tells me what's going to happen in my life over the next year. And I have to break it. I have to go back to like just trying to get through the hour. Like I can't even think about later today. I'm just trying to get through the hour.
Yeah.
You know, the next 5 minutes. And that really helps me when I feel like it's all too much.
Yeah, that's great. That's great that you say that. And adding to what you said earlier in this podcast also about the joy and the meaning doesn't have to be big, extraordinary things. The extraordinary sometimes comes in smaller packages. You know, the way the clouds are wisping, you know, when they're blowing in the sky, and observing a child learning to ride a bike, or whatever those things are, that, you know, to be mindful of those moments that have meaning for you and that make you feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
And we're gonna close out here. And before we do, though, I remind people that you are doing a class on February 26th.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Redefining Survivorship. And that's a class that's going to be both either in person or remote. People can Zoom into it or something. I don't know how they're doing that. I know smart people smarter than me have that all figured out. I just want to make sure people tune in and they can go to wellnesswithin.org and find it on the calendar and register for the class.
Awesome.
So before we part, any words of wisdom? I mean, we did a lot of talking today. Any last words of wisdom that you would want to share with our listeners?
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know why I just feel compelled to say, like, live your truth. Because for me, that really sort of began to release me from all the things that I felt confined by before. And my hope is that people don't have to experience cancer to get that. But gosh, it was one of the beautiful gifts that came out of all of this, which is that all the things that happened in my life, it was like training for this. And now, there, earlier when I was talking about these fragmented pieces of myself or parts of my life, now I'm like one me. I'm a doctor me, I'm a mom me, I'm a cancer survivor, and it's all like one integrated person. And I don't have these parts of myself that I'm like shoving away in some shame closet. It's just, you know, it's me. And I feel that that's really helped me to achieve like my best health and a true sense of well-being. And that was some really, really hard spiritual work. And I didn't really get a lot of that. I didn't get that guidance from my medical providers. That was sort of friends and support groups, other patients, talking to other people going through this stuff. And so I think sometimes people think about connection or support groups as sort of like, oh, I don't know, it's going to be really sad. That's going to be kind of a drag. I don't know if that's for me. But connecting with other people and hearing how they helped themselves, that helped to really heal me. And so I think kind of living your truth and then connecting with other people and finding out how they're living their truths and sort of, you know, advocating for one another. I think that's all part of the healing process. And I'm hoping to make that more accessible to people and part of the medical process. Like that's part of this, along with chemo, surgery, radiation, targeted therapy, immunotherapy. And we didn't even go over all the logistics. Like I really hope that people don't walk away from this conversation feeling like, oh, she's really out there, very unscientific. Like I am a evidence-based medicine provider. I follow the guidelines. I think it's really important that we do all of those things. And it's a yes and, a both and kind of thing. And that's what I think integrative medicine truly is. It's all the stuff that we expect of any sort of care guideline for our specific diagnoses. And it's somebody who can help shepherd you through the experience of like, is this trying to show me something? How can I live my life now? What do I do with this fear? How do I go on living after hearing the words like, you have cancer? So it's all the things. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. So I agree. I think there's people are not, what do they call it? A myth. I think there's a myth that a lot of the kinds of things that are integrative approaches to healing are kind of woo-woo, and they're not. There's so much, everything now is coming full circle to all the science base about all the modalities that you can use to integrate in with your traditional medical treatments. Yeah, I mean, that's just people mostly, I think sometimes it's people being afraid to like, if I let go of this and then grab onto that, and then I say, you take from both. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's just everything in life. There's room for all of this. It's like, yeah, what works for you.
And I feel it's important that Western allopathic medical doctors know the language of these other modalities because for safety, like we took an oath, do no harm, which means that I can't say like, oh, I don't want to hear about that supplement or don't do that. Like I know people are taking their supplements and I want them to tell me so that I can sort of look up what I can look up and tell them if they might interact or which doses or what labs should we follow. Like, you know, it's definitely holding both and a sort of full honesty. And like, if I don't know the answer, maybe I can find somebody who does. So, yeah.
Let me clone you though. Clone you. Or wait, you're already chasing this to have this multidisciplinary,
Yes. And we're going to be teaching learners, so residents and fellows that are rotating through to sort of hopefully demonstrate this way of thinking and of practicing medicine as the future of cancer care.
Amen.
Yeah.
All right. That is it for us, folks. And hopefully you've listened to all of this and take what you need and know that you are not alone in this journey. There are some really good folks out there. Obviously, Dr. Sam Siegel is one of those people who understands, has your back, and is here for you. Anyway, thank you, folks. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thank you so much, Sam. I really appreciate
all
the time that you give everyone and you've given to us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Take good care and see you soon.